Welcome to the Report Card with Nat Malkus, the education policy podcast from the American Enterprise Institute. In their new book, Getting Education Right, A Conservative Vision for Improving Early Childhood, K-12, and College, Rick Hess and Mike McShane argue that when it comes to education, conservatives have often been much clearer about what they're against than what they're for. So, what should conservatives be for in education? What values should a conservative vision for education be rooted in? And how should conservatives think about the last 20 years of education reform? To discuss these questions and more, I invited Rick and Mike onto the podcast. Rick Hess is the Director of Education Policy Studies here at AEI, and Mike McShane is the Director of National Research at EdChoice. Mike, Rick, welcome to the Report Card.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, man. Good to be with you.
All right. So, Mike, the book is called Getting Education Right, A Conservative Vision for Improving Early Childhood, K-12, and College. No workforce? But
We didn't go prenatal.
Yeah,
and we didn't. Once,
I thought this
once...
was going to be comprehensive. Is what I was what I was hoping for. No, it's a, you know, it is a big title. What are you guys trying to do with this book?
Well, look, I think it's premised on a couple ideas. One of which is that I think Rick and I both believe, though it's always dangerous trying to speak for him, that the right has tended to be much better at articulating what it's against than what it's for. So if we think about, you know, being against the student loan bailout, being against wokeness on campus, being against teachers unions, being against the Common Core, being against DEI, CRT, SEL, the whole panoply of acronyms.
Right.
And that's good. A lot of that stuff is bad, and it's right to oppose it. But just opposing things doesn't actually create the world that you want, right? You can stop bad stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to create a world full of good stuff. So part of what we were thinking about is how can we put together that vision of if conservative principles were sort of at the helm, what would our schooling system look like? And the sort of second point that it's based on, which I think is an important one, is that, you know, the right is uniquely positioned to be able to do this. You know, if we think about our friends over on the left, I mean, the student loan sort of bailout is like the perfect example of that. Like, what has been the Biden administration's great idea on higher education? Like, forgive student loans. And we could say, you know, setting aside whether we think that individual thing is a good idea or a bad idea, like, is that doing anything to make college better, to make it more effective, efficient, expand access to it, any of that? But that's the constituency that many of our friends on the left have to serve. You want to change K-12 education? Well, you got to go through the teachers unions. You want to do stuff in early childhood? Well, I mean, look at what like Bill de Blasio did in New York. You know, you have to go through these same sort of interest groups. But the right, like if we angered the teachers unions or people in, you know, college faculty lounge are mad at us, that ain't the end of the world, right? So we have much more space to be able to do these things. So we need to have this positive agenda. We have the space to do so. So our thought was, let's try and articulate some of these principles. What does conservative education policy look like? And then how can we sort of apply that? Frankly, we work sort of chronologically through children's lives.
So before we jump full into this, conservative, it's right there in the title. Rick, conservative can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. A lot of times it depends on where you sit, what that means. But what do you mean when you say conservative vision?
Yeah, and that's such a key point. We say right up front, look, if you're excited by a political personality, you know, Donald Trump or Tucker Carlson, that's not what we mean by conservative. You know, politics of personalities is not politics of principle. And there's a lot of flavors of conservatism. Most people who use these labels don't even know what they mean by them. Neocon and paleocon and this and that. So what Mike and I try to do is say, look, for us, conservative is really a disposition. It's a way of thinking about the world. It's a set of core beliefs about the importance of personal responsibility, about the importance of gratitude, about the importance of understanding tradition and that the world's a big, complicated place and that we should respect things that are working and not take them for granted. So for us, conservatism really starts from there. And as we say, look, you can find conservatives in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. You can find conservatives or people of conservative sensibilities all along kind of the educational spectrum. And we're like, look, more power to them. We're not worried about which party is going to embrace our ideas. And we're not worried about what label the ideas we talk about travel under. What we're trying to do is offer folks who come at the world the way we do a coherent way to talk about that and then a set of policies that they can carry forward in pursuit of that vision.
And so folks who are going to say like, well, I'm on the left, I'm progressive, I'm not going to find anything there I can use. I'm going to guess here, but you tell me if I'm off base, that a lot of those might find some things that they can say, well, that resonates with me. I get where he's coming from.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, we were fortunate enough to have some good friends on the left actually blurb the book, right? John Maeda up at Harvard, Rick Collenberg at the Progressive Policy Institute. And, I think what these guys say is there is stuff here that we don't buy some of this, or we don't buy a lot of it. But some of this makes sense. And in fact, there's a tendency for readers to say, well, these aren't even conservative ideas. These are just sensible ideas. And we're like, good.
Call it whatever you want.
We'll cool take some of the sensible ideas. Yes.
If you think this is just sensible, then what the hell are we fighting about? And why are we calling each other names? So that's right. So, our attitude is, look, we'd love folks. That's one of the reasons we did it with Teachers College Press. We'd love for it to be assigned in schools of education. We'd love for our friends on the left to read it. And where they think that we're making a good point, more power to them. Let's do that stuff together. And where they think we're off base, then let's at least have a principled debate about why we disagree.
So, Rick, about a year ago, we had you on for another book. And, dude, you write a lot of books. So, relax. But anyway, the Great School Rethink. And at that time, you said Great School Rethink wasn't really about policy prescriptions or reform agendas, about giving education leaders really the tools and the perspective to rethink schooling. This is a conservative vision. It's right there in the title. And you and Mike in this book do offer a number of actual policy ideas. So just, is Great School Rethink and getting education right at odds? How do these two sit with each other?
Yeah. No, they're not at odds at the least. I mean, this is, I think, one of the pathologies of the research and higher ed community today, is this notion that everybody has to own a niche. I remember when I was just starting out, I was in my 20s, I had just written this, my Spinning Wheels book, and I remember Larry Kuban, a wonderful, serious scholar at Stanford, sat me down and he said, Rick, you have an opportunity here to be one of the leading scholars of your generation of the politics of urban schools. And I remember thinking, my God, that's a narrow way to spend your life. So, look, I wrote The Great School Rethink because one of the things I find when I engage with folks who do the real work, not like the three of us, but people out in communities and schools, are questions about, well, how do we do more than just kind of get back to routine after the pandemic? And I like to think that having done this long enough, I have thoughts and insights and wisdom to share. For those folks, it isn't really about ideology or particular policy agendas, but it's just about how do you think about the work. This book, we write with a different part of our brain. This is a book where it's much more, here's unapologetically the values that Mike and I are starting from, and here's how we think about the world, and here's what we personally think is good and healthy for schools and communities. And it's a different intellectual project, but it's a different kind of exercise.
So, Mike, part of the premise of the book is that now is an opportune time for conservatives to take a lead on education. What do you think makes the current moment unique or particularly, why is now the time?
I mean, I think there's a confluence of events, right? So, obviously, the pandemic looms large in the background of so much of this, right? Particularly at K-12, but obviously had serious implications for higher education, for early childhood education, for daycare, for all of these things that we talk about in the book. The pandemic was this massive dislocating event that caused lots of people to borrow a word that we were just talking about, rethink, right? To rethink their relationship to schools, to rethink, well, like, what are we doing here? Like, what is the purpose of these institutions? What ends are they pursuing? Who are the types of people that we want to be working in these institutions? How do we want to organize them? So it would be crazy to not have that number one with a bullet to be that the pandemic was a huge thing. But I mean, look, and it happened after a fair bit of the writing that we've been doing. But I mean, look at all the stuff that's been going on in higher education in the past few months. I mean, the congressional hearings and then the having to sweep up the mess that's made in the congressional hearings. And I think that has been a sort of spotlight that has caused people to ask more questions. Obviously, it's a small number of institutions that are directly sort of put under that microscope. But again, it causes people to ask these sort of questions like, wait a second, like, what are these folks doing? What do they see their job as? What do they see these institutions as supposed to be doing? What ends are they going after? is that what I want? Do I want to pay a bunch of money to have my kid do that? Do I, as like a young person, is this the type of institution that I want to be a part of? So I think we've definitely seen that on the higher ed front. And then the last bit, just around sort of family policy, early childhood, and others, we have just seen these increasing costs. You know, so the whole affordability problem, the access issues, actually having good quality early childhood education or daycare for your kids when people are trying to work, part of this kind of broader cost of living problem that's hitting us in all sorts of different ways. So it's all of these things. And obviously the pandemic's part, and some of these are longstanding stuff that's going. I mean, we talk about God and man at Yale in this book. You know, William F. Buckley had their number in 1951. So a lot of the stuff ain't new, but all of these things are coming together. So I think it is a quite precipitous moment right now to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, and just to stretch that a bit, stretch Mike's point backward a bit, part of it, too, is, you know, when I first started doing this work in Washington, D.C. in the 2002, education change looked real different. It was really hard to get folks talking about higher ed. There was this kind of notion that somehow American higher ed was the best in the world. And when you took issue with that, folks on the right and left would be like, settle down. Early childhood was incredibly hard to get the right talking about, just because they were like, yeah, that's not a policy question. And on K-12, the world was enormously purple. There was, you know, in a lot of ways good and in some substantial ways bad, there was this bipartisanship that really shaped it. And so when you talked about these ideas in K-12, you didn't really talk about the dividing line was not conservative versus progressive. It tended to be a union or non-union, or accountability or not accountability, or choice or not choice. And the lines were interesting. What's happened, I think, over the last decade is you saw education unravel in a way that's reflected a lot of the polarization of the country for reasons we could talk about. I think it makes a lot of sense. Schools and colleges are very emotional subjects for people. And when you get polarized about a lot of things, you'd expect education to be part of that. Higher ed has obviously managed to push its way onto the agenda just by so alienating so many Americans. And early childhood has become a question of increasing salience. And on all of these, what's happened is because so much of the school reform infrastructure wound up being occupied by the left after kind of the ideological divorce, and because the right has just never really gotten into the game on early childhood, and because the higher ed conversation tends to focus pretty narrowly on questions of ideology and spending and less on questions of institution and reform, there was just, it felt to Mike and I think, when we started talking about this a couple of years ago, a real need for folks on the right to offer more cogent, coherent, principled visions, which would be for. Ours is certainly not the only one. I think nothing will make us happier than if this time, 2 years from now, there's 7 books like this, and people can argue about who's got the principles right and who's got the prescriptions right. But what we thought was, you know, what we can do is light a candle. And so this book was our effort to light a candle.
So I think a casual observer of ed policy focused on K-12 would say, hold on a second, conservative vision, this isn't new. No Child Left Behind was the big swing, right? Y'all had your swing, and then they'll say, and that was pretty good, or that was terrible, or whatever. How do you respond to, yeah, that was the conservative take? Was it?
I mean, for, as Rick said, different people envision conservatives differently. They define it in our terms. I think to our mind, that sort of massive increase in the federal government's role in education, an increasingly sort of technocratic and centrally managed education, sort of race-based outcome variables, doesn't strike us as having the humility and the sort of muddling through that we appreciate from sort of conservative thinking. So while it was supported by lots of Republicans, it doesn't necessarily strike me as the most conservative way of trying to solve the issues of American education policy.
And well, Rick, you also talked about this, like this purple education movement, which I don't think it's quite as purple as it once used to, as maybe it once was. But how do you make sense of that from this perspective? You're talking about a conservative vision. Is that something to aspire back to try and cultivate? Are we losing something? Can we get it back? I mean, how do you think about this in those kind of terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is that there's different time frames we can think about. We can think about education as, here's what it feels like the last 5 years. And you think back, you go, oh, it was so nice when there was bipartisanship 25 years ago. But if you roll it back long enough, actually kind of polarization and disagreements along community lines and ethnic lines and religious lines have been a healthy part. I mean, I'll say that a healthy part of the debates about American education going back to the founding. I know these debates make some people uncomfortable. That's the progressives of the early 1900s who said we're going to take politics out of schools by installing these bureaucrats on atop of these hierarchical systems. But it's not like they actually took the politics out of schools. They just separated the political process from the folks whose kids were being educated and wound up creating this kind of discordant relationship. Look, if we look back to the No Child Left Behind era, it's important to remember that when that got done, Republicans were just were suffering from a substantial Stockholm syndrome. They'd spent the 90s just getting walloped by Democrats and especially President Clinton on education. When Dole was running in 1996, the Democratic lead on who you trust in education was something like 65-25. I mean, it was astonishing. And, you know, one of the appeals of George Bush, President Bush, President Bush 43, when he ran was that he had been a champion of accountability and choice in Texas. But if you think back to the negotiations over No Child Left Behind, the choice components got given away early in the game. 3 months in, they gave up on the notion that kids would get vouchers with Title I funds. Real early in the game, they wound up having to agree that you would dramatically extend Washington's role and reach in terms of state education agencies, in terms of practices. You wound up with this mishmash, five-stage series of intervention strategies that were going to be mandated by the U.S. Department of Ed. Every state had to submit these hundreds of pages of compliance plans to Margaret Spelling's office at the White House where they would get signed off on. You wound up with... You can argue that there's certainly ideas No Child Left Behind which speak to the kind of conservatism that Mike and I talk about. The idea that schools ought to be responsible for doing their work well, the fact that we should care about whether kids are learning reading and math, the fact that, you know, transparency is a good thing. But in order to get the deal made, lots was given away. I wrote at the time, it was probably best understood as the bill Lyndon Johnson would have loved to pass. But couldn't possibly do, 35 years before. And sure, there are Republican fingerprints all over that law and conservative pieces of it. But I would argue that it wasn't the product of a principled conservative negotiation. It was a consequence of conservatives wanting to get something done, agreeing to the political needs of the Bush administration, and getting the little bits of what they wanted is part of a big bipartisan omnibus. And that's reality. But we want to be clear-eyed about those realities.
Yeah, and I think this isn't a book that says never compromise, right? Like, right. Hold the line, patriots. Like, that's not what this book is about. And this book actually isn't against the idea of bipartisanship. Like, obviously, like in so many places, that's the way it's going to have to happen. But it's starting from a clearly articulated, principled position, understanding what are those areas that are fuzzy and what are those ones you can give on and other ones that you won't want to. So this isn't a book that's against compromise or against bipartisanship. It's just from where we want to start all those conversations.
And, you know, and part of the problem is when you're not clear about that, you wind up with giveaways you didn't even intend. So the highly qualified teacher provision in No Child Left Behind, for instance, actually... I wrote this paper for the Progressive Policy Institute for Andy Rotherham, who had been Bill Clinton's special assistant for education back in 2001. It was getting waved around by Bill Hansen, Deputy Secretary of Education, at all kinds of meetings. I spoke on it at the White House. I was told that they loved this notion that we ought to have fewer barriers to who can teach, that what should matter was whether the school wanted to hire you and then whether you were serving the kids well rather than whether you had an ed school credential. But by the time the negotiating process worked through with Ted Kennedy's team in the Senate and George Miller's in the House, highly qualified teacher provision morphed into something that really felt like a ramp up of the paper chase in teacher hiring. Now, I think that's what happens when you lose track of what the principles are, of what you're trying to accomplish, and you wind up focused on getting the deal done, which is a natural political instinct. You wind up with making compromises that you regret. And so part of this is, like Mike says, compromise is part of life in a healthy democracy. We need more of it, but we want to make sure that if we're compromising, it's because we're starting from a place where we're fighting for the things we believe in rather than we're fighting to get a deal done.
So in that context, do you think that the educational reform movement and certainly conservative participation in it just suffers from the fact that we got a federalist education system, so the big game always seems federal, and so that's where people's eyes are when they want to be in the big game? I mean, we're talking about No Child Left Behind, which is the federal policy. It's the thing that has the name recognition. That shouldn't necessarily be where our eyes should be at, and it's not necessarily where we can bring our values to fruition. What do you say to conservative folks or just folks in general about the tension between, you know, trying to win the big game or trying to make steady strides?
Well, look, taking one step back from that is just that the world of education is substantially to the left of America in general. I mean, if you go onto any college campus, you know, the ed school is probably a standard deviation to the left of the campus writ large, which is, depending on what state you're in, either 1 to 2 or, God willing, probably 3 standard deviations compared to other places that are there. As a result, the teachers and many of the teachers who become administrators and those administrators who become superintendents and those superintendents who then staff state education agencies and federal education agencies and all of the people that have been sort of raised up in this area can start to believe the same things. And this is true even if they even politically identify differently. You know, on other issues they might, but if the only kind of perspective that you get throughout your preparation is the more kind of left-leaning version of it, you can just start to kind of imbibe those ideas of what it's going to look like. So even in red states, you might see the kind of people who are working in the bureaucracy that are there that would never think outside of the kind of box of, well, this is what schools look like, and this is why they look that way, and maybe we can talk about curriculum, we can do whatever, but when you guys are talking about school choice, like, no, we're talking within this particular system that happens. So I think that, yes, some of this is that there's the big ticket items and we have a federal system, but even within states and even within districts, in many cases that are in red areas or others, because the pipeline is such that you're spending between 4, 6, 8 years sort of swimming in this one particular way of thinking, that colors everything that happens, even for people who might not be ideologically simpatico with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so part of it's careerism. Same thing in higher ed, obviously. I mean, you know, Nat, you and I run programs at AEI where we get folks who strike us, I think, as, you know, centrist, center left, center right. But in terms of, you know, what you want to be writing about or researching, or how you frame it or what you cite in order to get funded, in order to get published, in order to get tenured at universities, there is just an enormous groupthink kind of suck towards the progressive side of the spectrum. So you got those waters. More specifically on your question about D.C., you know, I think it's the same thing. Jonah Goldberg wrote about this recently when it comes to this presidential greatness rankings, that there's a bias among the folks who do these presidential rankings towards people who expand the reach of the federal government. So if you create large new programs, if you create big new initiatives, you are much more likely to be seen as influential than if you're someone like Calvin Coolidge, who worked extraordinarily hard to hold the line on the role of the federal government. And I think you see that same bias play out in education, partly because it's human nature and then partly because of the field's biases.
So, look, writing this book to a conservative audience and hitting the mark seems harder today than it may have been before. So let me list out a couple of things. First of all, the pandemic, right? Very polarizing, particularly on schools. Like, I was counting the data. It was pretty polarized,
yeah.
Right? Okay, and so there's that. And then there's the culture war stuff, which is just so polarizing. And there's let's be honest, there's a whole bunch of cheap shots taken in the culture war. In fact, much of it seems like cheap shots. Yeah. And so that's extremely sort of politically polarizing, and all the iron filings line up really quickly. And to some degree, you're trying to write not with that grain, but against that grain, but not completely against it. It's not like, hey, this is all about a new purple bipartisan kumbaya. It's about a true conservative vision. And I just wonder how big you see those headwinds currently in the education zone, because I got to tell you, they look tough.
See, it's funny because I don't know if I see it the same way, in the sense that it seems like when I'm talking to parents or teachers, and maybe even college students or others, like a lot of people are frustrated. Like they're frustrated with what's happening in schools. And I think many of them feel like a kind of fringe has dominated this conversation, whether it's in sort of preparation programs where the fringe is on the left, whether, as you're pointing out, it's on social media, where in many cases the fringe is on the right. And most people who are, you know, parents are intensely practical people. The vast majority of teachers that you come across really want to do right by their kids. Administrators do, but they can often feel buffeted by this culture war thing that's happening. So I think a lot of what we talk about in the book, whether we're talking about how to teach American history, whether we talk about standing up for rigor, whether we talk about school discipline or those, I mean, maybe I'm crazy, but I think a lot of the ways we talk about it are kind of 70-30, right? We're talking to the meat of the bell curve here of people who want us to teach American history in a way that both recognizes American greatness, but also recognizes ways in which we haven't lived up to that. That believes, you know, that advanced courses in mathematics and the science are not bad for kids. And even if that might mean that some kids are doing better than others, that no, we should still have those and that's still okay. The people believing that parents should have more say in what's going on with their kids, should have more choices that are available to them. Like, I actually don't think those things are polarizing. So I think in many ways it's a way to, we'll anger certain people that are certainly on the left of this, but it honestly comes back to what you were saying about at the beginning, that a lot of sort of center left people, the notes that we're getting, the people that are saying are like, yeah, a lot of this seems sensible. It's like, I know you guys aren't happy either. You're not happy. We're not happy. You know, we can come together on a lot of this stuff.
And, you know, and that, I think to your point, I mean, one of the things we'll see, I'm sure, is, you know, Tucker Carlson went to Russia, you know, a couple weeks ago.
I saw that.
Yeah. To, you know, talk about how awesome Russian grocery stores are because they have produce and bakeries. And
you use the coin to get the card. Like, you've never gone to Aldi before, yes, but whatever.
You know, and I'd swear I was seeing that in American airports back in last century. But, you know, hey, but Russia's really ahead of the curve. And so there's certainly plenty of folks on the right who have gone into this performative nuttiness. Tucker Carlson, you know, he wishes any American city were as nice as Moscow. Well, that's just loony. And the fact that we've got people saying these kinds of things routinely on the American right, you know, they're jealous of Viktor Orban. It's exactly as nutty as the Americans who've always been jealous of Cuba's literacy program or Cuban healthcare. Fortunately, I think, like Mike said, I mean, we think that either end, that's 10% on the left, 10% on the right. And what's happened is, I think when you're talking about things like DEI or critical race theory or privilege walks and privilege worksheets, that kind of over-the-top performative lunacy is a lot of what folks encounter when they see the criticisms of college, when they hear people speaking up at school board meetings. And I think what we're offering is a more grounded way for people to say, yeah, you know what? I think it's crazy that San Francisco wants to rename schools named for Abraham Lincoln and do it while schools are closed. And that they want to spend $250,000 for woke kindergarten trainers to come in and teach five-year-olds how to imagine a world without police. Like, you can write snarky, angry tweets and make TikToks about this. Or, as we're trying to suggest, there's a way to talk about these things where we think the polling shows lion's share of teachers and parents are going to be with you. And how do we offer that in a way that actually offers a firm basis? Now, we wouldn't say it's this really bipartisan because it's not bringing together people who want to do Democratic and Republican talking points. But I think it is, you know, a couple of years ago, Pedro Neguera and I did this book, Common Ground, In Search of Common Ground. I think it's, you know, the place where you can actually find common ground among lots of those practical people and communities, whether or not it's the kind of thing that you can get, again, kind of Republican and Democratic governors to kind of agree to parrot public statement.
And you can see this in the rooms that we're in, where things are behind closed doors, and you get a lot of nodding along and like, yeah, I know what you're saying. Like, I'm right there with you. But I can't really say that in public as much. It's like,
no, this is the thing that we always get.
Say yes. Some of this stuff in public, y'all.
No, this is always what we get is friends, colleagues, whatever, because they know that you're like the one conservative person that's in the thing. They're always like, well, you know, like, I'm kind of with you on that one. They're like, whatever, like, that's right. It's like, yeah, I know.
But if, don't out
if,
me.
If all of you just, yeah, if all of us just said it out loud, though, you could get rid of a bunch of this craziness. So if they want to swim in our wake, that's a-okay.
We, you know, we should have dedicated this book to, you know, all of those faculty who write to the three of us,
yeah,
who are like, all right, I really can't believe I'm telling you this, but, and they're like in a chair. That's the DEI chair of X.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're going to love this one.
Dedicated to the silent quarters of the faculty lounge. So look, in this book, you guys do talk about some specific policy proposals, but it's not like, hey, here's the list, like the, you know, stop and start with where each one stands for something. Most of the book is more for a general audience, and it's about how the various parts of the system should work. And you root this in some values. And these values, it strikes me, are right kind of where you're talking about in these things that are not really controversial. They're not like pitched battles in some sort of political war. But what are some of those values? What are exemplars of this that can kind of give folks a flavor for where you're going and why?
Sure. No, it's funny.
And also, Mike, let me just add on to that. Why anchor it to values at all? Like, why not?
Perfect.
Let's do some policy proposals.
Yeah,
please.
I'll start with the second half first. Part of it is about being a conservative in a big country like America. I think we believe in, as much as possible, local people coming up with solutions to their own problems. We're not necessarily supportive of grand sweeping proposals that'll work everywhere. Well, so if I don't know, you know, if I was made superintendent of the Poughkeepsie schools tomorrow or something, and I don't know anything about them, right? I can't tell you what to do in Poughkeepsie, but what I can do is articulate some principles so that policymakers, if you are a state legislator in Kansas, or if you're an assistant superintendent in Albany or whatever, you can say, okay, here are the problems that are in front of us. What are the ways I should be thinking about them? How should I envision solutions? What are the values? What are these principles? So that because two different districts or two different states might apply those principles in different ways due to the particular peculiarities of their teacher labor market or whatever is going on there. So that's part of negotiating a tension that you have as conservatives, is that we're not sort of the utopians with big centrally planned things. We want to give people space to solve their own problems, but we want to give them guardrails to do that. And that's sort of what these principles are. We articulate eight of them. I don't necessarily know if we have to go through all
you
the references, or it's like
all.
A quiz, right?
Give me some highlights, man.
I mean, I'll get to do some of my favorites, and maybe Rick will do some of his favorites. No, and obviously my first one that I love is a Rick Hess chestnut that we had to work in here. But it's this idea that education is a handshake. And I love Rick and I, a lot of our thinking probably was forged, and Rick and I were both teachers. So both of us have been in the classroom, and we see this dynamic at play. And if you think of this handshake that's happening, it's, you know, on a micro level, it's between student and teacher. On a slightly more macro level, it's between families and schools. And this is something that, again, any teacher will tell you, any administrator will tell you, any parent will tell you, that in order for that kid to learn, both sides of that handshake need to be working. Right? So we want teachers who are well prepared, who are using their best practices, who are knowledgeable, who are passionate. We want all of those things. But you could have all of those things in a teacher, and if they're not being supported by that child's family, if that kid is showing up, doesn't want to learn, doesn't want to get with the program, and no one at home is telling them to sort of do that, they are going to be banging their head against a wall. And we can act like it's different, and we can pretend and think happy thoughts about it, but that's the way that this thing goes. And so while there has been so much conversation, and I think rightfully so, about things like parents' rights, we want to give parents more choices, more opportunities here, I think it is a deeply conservative insight to say we also have to think about parental responsibilities. We have to think about the responsibilities of parents, of children, particularly as they age, to behave themselves and to apply themselves, and the responsibilities that are on the other half of that. Frankly, I think some of the conversations that we've had in education reform in the last one or two decades has really leaned on one side of that handshake much more than the others. And when I hear teachers upset about that, oh, you're constantly, you want to grade me based on my kids' test scores or whatever. Well, you know, a third of them don't show up every day or whatever, and that's completely outside of my control. Like, yeah, actually, you're right. You're right. Like, that's actually not fair, and that's not right. So we don't want to let either side off the hook. You can't just blame teachers. You can't just blame families. They need to be working together. I'll just say one more that I also love because, you know, when we talk about our conservative vision, one of the quotations that we use to ground it is from a British philosopher that I wish more Americans knew, but Sir Roger Scruton. He just passed away a couple of years ago. But, and I'll slightly butcher the quote probably, but it's, you know, conservatism begins from a notion that all adults readily share, that good things are difficult to build and easy to destroy. And it sort of goes to our 70-30 thing, right? All adults know this, like these kind of small C conservative principles that are there. In his great book called How to Be a Conservative, if you want an introduction to Scruton, you got How to Be a Conservative. He has another short book called Conservatism, An Introduction to the Tradition. Both very good. But in How to Be a Conservative, he talks about education and he coined this term oikophilia.
I hear it all the time, Mike.
I know. It's basically, it just rolls off the tongue. No, but oiko, you actually probably do here because oiko is the Greek word for home. And that's where economics, oikonomika, the study of home, like that's where it actually came from. And what he talked about instilling oikophilia is this idea that schools should instill love. Love of one's home, love of who one is, love of one's family, love of one's community. He brought it out slightly from the home to mean the community, the nation, like where they're from. And we think that obviously lots of schools across the country are not really big on instilling oikophilia. They're not really big on instilling love. But if we think about the types of schools that we imagine kids would want to be in, that teachers want to teach in, that parents are psyched to send their kids to, they are ones that are based like in love, where you're really trying to instill great works of literature. We quote a great classical educator who says, you know, we want to assign kids books that are worthy of their affection. It's like, God, I love that. You're right. Because think of all the garbage and wasted time that we spend on things. No, we want to be really thoughtful about the formation that's taking place of these young people. And we want to instill in them a love for their country, a love for their family, a love for their history, and a great gratitude for all of the sacrifices that were there to make that happen. And again, that can stretch across. That affects higher education policy. That affects how we approach K-12, but even in early childhood and others, maintaining those connections to family, to community, and instilling those deep communal bonds of love.
So, Rick, let me ask you about this vision construction and its importance, because you know me, I love a good technocrat, right? Like, you know, I'm all about like getting the data and so forth. But we often talk about schools like there's inputs and outputs and there's a little black box. But all we just need to do is just crank this dial a little bit more or do these technocratic adjustments. This is a little bit more with how we create structures and how those structures stay aligned with a coherent vision. But a lot of the time, we're talking about a technocratic fix here and there. This may not be a fair question, but is the antithesis to the vision that you guys are talking about more likely to be an alternative vision or just sort of a technocratic amalgam of what has been and sort of, you know, some sort of Frankensteinian contraption that doesn't align to a particular vision?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Let me try to answer it this way. You know, our colleague Yuval Levin a couple of years ago wrote his wonderful A Time to Build book, where he talked about institutions that were once formative had become increasingly performative. That instead of people becoming members of institutions in ways that would shape them into better people, institutions became platforms where you get to try to attract notice and be heard. And I think one of my points is that that's very much a problem in education, that, you know, Mike just talked about, you know, learning to love the great books. We quote this teacher who wrote a long essay for Ed Week a couple of years ago about when she has her students read Shakespeare because she has to. Every time something's misogynist, she says boo and gives them a thumb down. And we're like, well, it's nice that Shakespeare doesn't conform to your, you know, 400 year later notions of, but that's not really about helping students inquire in the, or that's not asking them to talk about constructs and expectations. That's about you performing and sharing your, so the fundamental insight, I think, is that schools are always formative institutions. That's true of early childhood, K-12, higher ed, that there's always a question of what kind of people are we raising? What are we holding up as worthy of admiration? What do we want people to know? What do we want them to interrogate? And it's just, frankly, a mistake for us to ever imagine that you can do technocratic educational improvement without thinking about that. And I think that was one of the problems in retrospect. And it's always, hindsight's always easier. But of early 21st century reform, one of the ways you got that bipartisan agreement was we agreed not to talk too much about things like values or what's important. So what was important was what we knew how to test. And what we knew how to test was reading and math. So if schools were doing less civics and history, we didn't worry too much about that. If kids were getting less recess, we didn't actually talk about what did that tell you. We weren't even all that interested in how you taught reading and math. Reading first was part of the push for No Child Left Behind, but that fell by the wayside amidst some of the technocratic infighting. So look, values are always going to be there. And our point is that one, there's actually a lot more agreement on values than you might recognize just from surfing social media and listening to the lunatics in the Oberlin faculty lounge. That when it comes to, do we think students should learn that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were critical in expanding the reach of human liberty? 80 to 90% of Democrats say yes. If you poll Americans on should students learn about Jim Crow and Korematsu and the Trail of Tears, more than 90% of Republicans say yes. There's not actually fundamental disagreement on that kind of stuff. When we talk about whether biological boys should be playing on girls' sports, turns out overwhelming majority of Americans say no. When you talk about race-based affirmative action for college, turns out so some of these things that we treat as if we're at each other's throats, there's actually broad opinion. And then there's questions about how do you bring that into schools in ways that's respectful of everyone, that protects every student, and that creates a healthy learning environment for every child. And those are fair questions. But one, we somehow seem to treat this as if there, you know, 50% of folks are on one side and 50% on the other, and there's no way we can agree, which is just, I think, inaccurate and particularly problematic when it comes to formative institutions. And then, look, one way to think about this is we've spent a lot of time and energy in the last 10, 20 years talking about inclusion. I remember 30 years ago when I was at Harvard Ed School learning to be a teacher, we talked about it ad nauseum. And there was the notion that for every child, you wanted to be respectful of their culture, of their tradition, of their nation's history. The idea that, you know, anybody should call somebody else's country, you know, a shithole, like Donald Trump famously did, would be extraordinarily frowned upon. Right. And yet, if these same schools where teachers have learned not to be disrespectful and to make sure they're inclusive, when they turn around and talk about American history, students are told that they live in a slaveocracy. They're given Howard Zinn stuff, you know, fraudulent history, which depicts not America as a one-dimensional white knight, which was always problematic, but now as a one-dimensional villain. So part of this here is simply asking that we make sure we understand where we have common values, that we talk seriously about how to bring those into schools, and then that we expect our schools to abide by the values that they pay lip service to, not only for folks who are new to this country, but also for Americans who, you know, should learn to feel a sense of love and affection and gratitude for their communities and their traditions and their home.
All right. We take a break every time for Grade It. You guys were both teachers. Mike, universal kindergarten. And the book, you kind of push back on universal pre-K. What about universal kindergarten?
So I'm giving a grade to the idea of universal kindergarten?
Right.
I mean, an A? They seem to be doing all right. I don't know. I don't hear a lot of people out there saying we need to get rid of kindergarten. I'll give it an A.
All right.
Sure.
Rick, I got two in a row for you. The potential upside of AI for high school education.
Oh, upside always gets an A. Upside is a good thing.
Okay. How about the evident upside or how much upside we've seen for the internet in high school education?
Oh, you know, here's one of those ones where I got to do the grade/grade. Potential A, you know, actual impact, C minus.
Why C minus?
You know, I think A, kids spend a lot of time surfing. I'm not sure how much the time they're surfing on their work is actually delivering more knowledge or understanding. I don't know, my kids' homework, the stuff they pull off the internet that they cut and paste into their assignments, I'm not sure how much of it's actually understood. And B, you know, I think what's happened is we, you know, one of the few pieces of good Ed research I've seen in the last 12 months was a study comparing, for instance, digital reading to book reading. And the fact that we now have kids spending more time reading on screen in school, I think is actually bad, both for teaching them to like having a book in your hand and for comprehension and skill building.
Mike, the effectiveness of the school choice movement over the past two decades.
I'd give it a B. I think, you know, with emphasis that that GPA rapidly rose like a senior trying to get ready for college. Yeah, I mean, obviously a massive growth in that improvement in the types of policies that they're starting to advance that are much more universal. And I think that are actually trying to get out there and make, you know, drive changes in the types of schools and educational environments that'll be there. There's obviously lots of states that still need to go. But no, I think especially given what they were up against and how long the hill was, I think B's good.
All right, Rick, you mentioned it, the state of education research.
Oh, D minus. Let's see. You know, I'm going to mark it up from an F.
Okay.
Because there is some solid work where, you know, Tom Kane's folks at Harvard do some useful stuff. You know, I think Raj Shetty's stuff is interesting. You know, Tom D has times where I'm not quite sure I buy what's going on, like with his two thumbs up on ethnic studies curricula in California. I'm not sure about the methodology. I know you and I were chatting recently about that tablet critique. But look, I think, you know, what you got to remember is there's 30,000 people, give or take, at universities doing education research. There's thousands more at a whole bunch of big education research shops. For the amount of useful inquiry that gets done or the share of this stuff that answers important questions and contributes constructively, I feel like a D minus, even with the fact that there is some good work getting done, feels like it might verge on the edge of being generous.
Mike, grade giving middle schoolers smartphones.
F. Yeah, there seems to be, you were talking about upside and downside earlier. There seems to be almost no upside and almost all downside. I think the emerging research that's coming out of it is, I think, obvious to anyone who's thought about this. Like, kids are not ready for that. They need to be spending time IRL, as the kids might say, right? Like, they need to be spending time in real life, learning to deal with one another and that. It does not seem to me like cell phones have helped young kids at all, and they're debatable for older people as well.
Rick, state of civics education today.
Oh, F. Flat F. You know, the RAND teacher panel stuff a couple years ago reported that more folks teaching civics think it's important for kids to learn about climate change than about American social, political, and economic institutions. I don't blame the teachers necessarily for that. I blame the programs that have trained them, the trainers who are telling them what to focus on, the curricula they're working with. But look, I mean, I think we've lost the plot. Civics education is not supposed to be about tell everybody else how you think the world should look. It's supposed to be about learning how a free country works, why institutions exist, about shared responsibilities. And I think we're doing a terrible job at all of that.
Mike, American arts education.
D minus, maybe more. Yeah, I don't think that, young people are encountering great works of art. They're not encountering them in ways that are helpful to their life, even for people who might not ever be artistically inclined. But understanding what great works of art have to tell us about who we are and about history and all of these things, I just feel like so much of arts education is kind of bloodless and uninteresting. And then you take kids to a museum and like absolutely knocks their socks off. They're like, wow, this is the craziest thing. Like, it's so cool and so wonderful. And it's like, well, I feel like we could give them at least some facsimile of this regularly, but I just don't see a ton of that happening.
If I could just editorialize on that one, this is nothing more than an impression. I've never seen any data on this, but it does seem to me, from what I hear from teachers and parents, is a remarkable amount of arts right now is infused with like SEL or larger kind of school culture creation, which I don't think is good for art. Maybe it may or may not be good SEL, but it seems to me that it's pulling us away from art as a creative endeavor, is trying to help kids tap kind of their interest in music or creativity. And it feels like the same kind of unhealthy repurposing that we've done in different ways at different points.
All right, Rick, entrepreneurship and education.
Good book. A, baby. you know, I mean, it's an interesting tension. I think conceptually that entrepreneurial impulse is a huge part of what makes a difference. Whether or not we've created an environment in which educational entrepreneurs are actually doing good work, there I think I'd be much more CC minus. When you look at what, say, the Biden administration is doing to for-profit operators, you look at the incentives for colleges not to worry about whether or not their students are actually benefiting, particularly under the changing guidelines on federal student loans. When you look at K-12 and simply the walls of regulatory and rule-made headaches for folks trying to think differently about how you use teachers, about how you solve problems, for the impediments for folks in the early childhood space. So educational entrepreneurs themselves, I think they got a lot to offer, especially, you know, educators and problem solvers, in terms of our ability to actually take advantage of those folks. C minus.
Last one to you, Mike. What's the health of the handshake in American education right now?
I thought it was like creative ones or, oh no, the,
no, the handshake, right? The handshake between parents and schools.
So the health of the handshake itself, I would give like, I would say like maybe B minus C plus, in the sense of in the actual real world, in thousands and thousands of schools across the country, there are teachers and families working together to create great schools and great classrooms and great environments. Like, it's happening in lots of places. Where I would give a much lower grade is to how we sort of talk about that, how, you know, if you step into an ed school and talk about it, if you look at how that stuff is happening on social media or others, that's where it's like D minus F territory, because people, as we sort of alluded to earlier, don't want to talk about it or afraid to talk about it. But in lots and lots of places across the country, this is happening. Your parent-teacher organization is working with the school. Parents are coming to parent-teacher night. You know, they're probably, a lot of them are happening, you know, now-ish. And hundreds and thousands of parents are rocking up to those and wanting to do right by their kids and hold up their end of their bargain. And teachers are doing the same.
You know, and it's not just the ed schools, right? I mean, one of the points we make is that, you know, part of the problem with the bipartisan era is that conservatives got out of the habit of talking about parental responsibility. And so right now on the right, you'll hear a lot of talk about parent rights, which I think Mike and I agree is good and healthy and which we wholeheartedly support. But those parent rights need to be, like Mike said, you know, paired with parental responsibilities. And you don't hear those voices on the right saying to parents, take your kid's phone away at 8 o'clock at night. Make sure your kid's in bed at a good hour. Wake your kid up. Make sure their homework is done. Get them to school on time. So, you know, when we're talking about the problem, there's a problem on the left, but there's also a failure on the right to lean into these things. And I think that's part of what we're trying to get at in the book.
What a smooth transition to my next question. Thanks for playing great it, guys. But one interesting part of the book is that you guys spend a lot of time focusing on policy areas that aren't neatly in the education sphere, right? So some examples are these: child tax credit, paid parental leave, urban planning, foster care, child internet use. Why?
Well, I think it's part of this broader thing that we're trying to do here, that this isn't like a collection of policies, an agenda that a governor or someone could run with. We want to talk about what it means to raise children, what it means to, you know, education sort of writ large, not just what's happening inside of school, but what's happening outside of schools and the forces that are affecting those things as well. And I think that oftentimes, and it's not just a sort of a conservative vision, but I think the education vision in general has become narrowed. And it's become, well, like, we're just going to talk about what goes on in K-12 schools, or then maybe we'll add a little bit onto that. And it's like, well, a lot of other stuff happens in kids' lives. A lot of stuff happens before they get to school or after they're in school. And a lot of these things that I think conservative policymakers should be thinking about, just like we want to talk about what sort of schools we want to have. It's a subset of the question, like, what types of communities do we want to live in? And so we have stuff in there about things like urban planning and others, because not just the cost of living problems of zoning reforms and all of those things, but just like general, like, quality of life stuff of, like, are you able to take your kids out and around? You have parks. What are we talking about? Or, you know, pedestrianized streets where you don't have to drive everywhere for kids. Like, these are serious quality of life things that I think a conservative disposition has things to share and has things to say about that. But it's not often one that we really hear. So I think if we're going to write a book that's about a bigger picture here, then, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, let's talk about a lot of this other stuff too.
Rick, you're nodding. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, the book's title is Getting Education Right. And I think one of the things that again, this is one of the mistakes I think we made, say, for instance, with No Child Left Behind, or when conservatives got excited, you know, some conservatives got excited about Race to the Top, is schooling and education are formative. That means they're anchored, as Mike and I talk about, in families and communities. And so this idea that you want to talk about schooling without talking about, are we putting families in, right? I just said that we want to challenge parents to make sure they're doing the things that are going to help their kids reach their full potential. But again, we also need to make sure we're putting families in a place where they have the tools and the resources they need. This seems like a really healthy kind of conservatism to us, to where we're coming from. I think some of our friends on the left probably actually agree with that. Again, so much the better. But when we don't talk about this, I think one of the reasons conservatives have tended to do so poorly with teachers, whereas we do so well, say, with cops, is when it comes to cops, we're not only talking about, hey, we respect the work you do, but we're showing that respect. We're saying we believe in safety. Safety can't just be cops have to swim against the tide. When it comes to teachers, though, too often we've been like, yeah, we say we respect what you do, but we're not willing to do anything or call on anybody else to do their part. And so partly the way that we show real respect for schools and for the formative role in education is by making clear we're talking about what does it look like to do that well. And it can't all just fall on the backs of colleges or schools or teachers. It's got to be about how do we create the kinds of communities where we can let our students and our kids, grow into the kinds of people we want them to be.
So I don't want to commit the error that you're trying to get me to not commit, which is to put everything on the schools. But a lot of the people who are going to read this book are going to be, you know, folks in schools, dealing with schools, leading schools. And if you want to project this vision or a coherent vision for the institution that you're working in, what advice do you have for school leaders who are trying to say, you know, I need to push forth a vision rather than a policy program or our next review project or whatever it's going to be that's going to bring the change?
Yeah, there was that like management book that came out a couple years ago. Was it Start With Why? I think that's always a good, if you're a school leader, if you're a leader of any sort of organization, starting with like, well, why are we here? Right? Like, what are the ends that we are trying to pursue? Because, you know, as Rick's work documented and many others have, a lot of these rules and routines and norms kind of build up over time for reasons that we don't always necessarily know. And listen, as good conservatives, we ticked the box where we have to cite Chesterton's fence in here, right? Never tear down a fence until you know why it was put there in the first place. And so it's important to always, if you're going to make changes, understand why the things that you are changing were there. But I think thinking from this bigger perspective, because what have we heard a lot recently? You know, we want to raise reading and math scores, right? Or we want to raise like the graduation rate or others. Like, is that the summum bonum of your institution? Like, what? No one's going to line up to do that. No one's excited. No one's going to make sacrifices to do that. If that's your pitch to parents, if that's your pitch for teachers, is we want kids to read better and do math better, and sort of everything else is a distant also ran. It's like, that's not going to get people out up and out of bed in the morning. But when we have this greater vision of the types of institutions that we have, the norms that exist in them, the values that they're supporting, the types of people that are participating, both the parents and the kids and the teachers that are coming together, that I feel like is a vision that people will get behind, that will sacrifice for, that will work for, that will compromise for in order for that to happen. So having that clearly articulated big picture, like, why are we doing this? Where are we going? What does winning look like? Right? Like, if we do all of this stuff, what can we expect this to be for your kids, for our community, and for others? I think that that's good leadership across a lot of different areas, but would be particularly good for schools.
So looking forward, you argue now's an opportune time for conservatives to take the reins and to lead on education. Do you think that will actually happen? And if it does, what will it take?
My record of prognostication is mediocre at best. So, you know, will it actually happen? Who the hell knows? I do think there's an enormous opportunity here. One, you know, the challenge for our friends on the left, like Mike said, is that huge parts of the Democratic coalition make it hard for even really thoughtful folks on the left to lead on these issues. their ties with the teacher unions, the faculty lounge, the kind of the college cartel, mean that they can't really push much in the way of fundamental change. So mostly what you get is subsidizing or supersizing kind of the status quo. That means there's an open playing field. The only thing stopping those of us who think of ourselves as conservative of whatever stripe to tackle this stuff is whether we're capable of mounting the vision, devising policies, and then working together with folks all across the spectrum who are frustrated at the status quo. Well, look, there's lots of policy agenda out there. We've got, you know, here at AEI, Max Eden runs a conservative ed reform network for us. There's ideas just laying there on the shelf for folks to pick up from local to state to federal to philanthropy. A frustration, Mike alluded to it before. I mean, you know the polling better than we do. Extraordinary frustration among, you know, among educators, among parents. So the real question is, can we actually muster the will and the strength of character to put together some kind of coalition that will move these things? Well, I mean, there I got my doubts. You look at the state of the American right now, it seems a whole lot more interested in performance and personalities than principle. But look, you know, you can't do this work unless you're willing to kind of roll up your sleeves, keep trying, and figure that, you know, there's always tomorrow. And that's kind of how I come at it.
Yeah, I would say I'm perhaps somewhat more optimistic, particularly like the state level, because I think we do see conservative leaders that are really stepping up and making a kind of full-throated picture of education policy, not just pulling one lever or the other, but a central part of what they're trying to do. So Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, Ron DeSantis in Florida, Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas, Kim Reynolds in Iowa. You know, they're not just picking one or two things, but actually trying to articulate, this is what we're looking at for our teacher workforce. We're looking at reading preparation. We're looking at school choice. We're looking at CTE. We're doing all of this sort of stuff. Now, again, part of it is, you know, how those folks measure success. I don't know. I'm not a politician, where it's one of those things where it seems like this is a very good way for you to be a very successful and beloved governor that, like, later on you get, I don't know, an airport or a bridge or something named after you, which seems pretty cool to me. Maybe if those people have like presidential ambitions and it's not enough to like get them to be the Republican nominee for president, they would see that as a failure. People would say, oh, you know, education's not enough for that. But it seems to me across a lot of states, you know, Greg Abbott's trying to do stuff in Texas around this. Arizona, Doug Ducey did this for a long time. And we can keep going down the list of a lot of folks that are interested in doing that. But at least particularly on the state level, it does seem like conservative governors are saying we need to have a fuller picture of education policy. And it's going to be central to what we're doing to try and make our state a better place to live.
So, Rick, take us out. Some low-hanging fruit from the book that you think could help make substantive positive differences. I mean, what would you tell conservatives? If you could just say a few things, where would you ask them to focus?
Let's just draw two. Early childhood and higher ed. Higher ed, we've seen this extraordinary pushback from donors and alumni against elite colleges that are engaging in crazy groupthink rather than free inquiry. Don't just complain and don't just kind of threaten to not write a check. Stop writing checks. Write those checks to new institutions. And not necessarily the University of Austin and not just necessarily trying to mimic Minerva, but actually saying, look, let's get back to what we used to do a century ago, which was build new institutions of higher education in this country that are built, designed, and equipped to meet the challenges of today. There's tens of billions of dollars in higher ed philanthropy a year in this country. If some substantial chunk of that started to redirect, that would have a real impact on the options that we started to create. Early childhood, Mike mentioned Glenn Youngkin's work in Virginia. His folks rolled out just a couple months ago a really promising approach to early childhood. Most of what the right has been for on early childhood is not doing what the left wants to do.
Right.
Bill de Blasio tacked a couple of grades onto the front end of the New York City public schools, said, hey, guys, here's a great deal. You can put your four-year-old on a bus, ship them to a building with a bunch of other kids. They can sit in a unionized, really expensive, rundown facility for 180 days a year, and then we'll get them home to you at 2 o'clock, whether or not you're done with your workday. What Youngkin's saying is there's better ways to do early childhood. Let's actually aggressively look to encourage employers to put early childhood on premises. Let's think about how do we handle the tax code or employment so that it's actually attractive for employers to offer this as a perk. How do we make it easier in terms of the red tape? How do we build navigators that make it easier for parents to find appropriate early childhood. So look, let's talk and push for expanding parental empowerment in K-12. Let's make sure we're addressing toxic dogmas wherever they are in education. But let's also get focused on building things that work for Americans. Let's get focused on creating opportunities to solve real problems. And if we do that, and if we do it from a place that starts from principle, I think we'll also find that it's easier to work on pushing forward those values that are so broadly shared.
Thanks for listening to The Report Card with Nat Malkus. And special thanks to our guests, Rick Hess and Mike McShane. We'll include a link to Getting Education Right, A Conservative Vision for Improving Early Childhood, K-12, and College, as well as some of Rick and Mike's other work in the show notes. Also, thanks to our producer, Ellie Lucas. He makes this podcast possible. Remember, you can subscribe to The Report Card on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download podcasts. And when you're there, take a minute to leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. As always, you can send your comments, questions, or topic suggestions to ed.podcast@aei.org. That's all for this episode. I'm Nat Malkus.